And in preparing these thoughts this morning, they're not original. I stole this lesson from Brother Al Edwards in 1974. Actually, I wrote the lesson, but I stole the title. That's the only thing I could remember. And Brother Edwards was Command Sergeant Major at Fort Rucker, Alabama. And Brother Edwards, I thought a lot of him. And a Command Sergeant Major in the Army, you respect it. Brother Edwards, you know, he stood about this tall. And Brother Edwards was a commanding figure in spite of being this tall. And the name of his sermon was Taking the Knots Out of the Devil's Tail. And, you know, I just remembered that all this time. I couldn't remember exactly what it was about, but I remembered several points. And, you know, what do? You always go to the Internet, and the Internet has the answer for everything. Taking the knot out of the devil's tail. There's nothing there. There was a country song I found out, Taking the Knots Out of the Devil's Tail. And there's some movie they're trying to come out with, Taking the Knots Out of the Devil's Tail. Had nothing to do with it. So, you know, there's enough stuff that it was pretty easy to come up with. And I started, and you know how you get to surfing on the Internet, and I started trying to come up with the idea, where did we get this idea of the devil wearing this funny red suit with the little horns and the little long tail, and where did we get the idea of him having, and nothing seemed to come up with the idea of him having knots in the devil's tail, you know. That's just not there. And we just made that up, I think. And they seemed to come up with the idea of him having this funny suit as a result of a cartoon. And they didn't really mention the cartoon. But when you look at the Bible, we're going to do a play on words here for a little bit. And the first place that it talks about taking the knot out of the devil's tail is in Genesis chapter 3 and verse 1. If you want to follow the reading there, it says, Now the serpent was more cunning than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made. And he said to the woman, Has God indeed said, You shall not eat of every tree of the garden? There's that word, not. And we're just doing a play on words is all we're doing. You shall not eat of every tree of the garden. And Satan's purpose here was to divide man and God and cast enmity between them by driving a wedge of division. At the very beginning, what did he do? He just changed one little word, that word not. Satan is suggesting that if God really loved you, he would not have withheld any fruit in the garden from you. His misquote was on purpose. He did that, and he made it just as close to the original quote as he could, except for that one little word, that not. He wanted to cast doubt on God's goodness. He didn't say, Behold all the good things God's created for you in the garden. He focused on the one restriction. He's saying, If God really loved you, He wouldn't have placed restrictions on you. And this is what He was doing with Adam and Eve. And that's one of Satan's tools today. He tells Christians, If there was really a God, He would not place these restrictions upon you. You'd be free to pursue truth. And you'd be free to choose truth. And you wouldn't have restrictions upon you in this life. And in taking this knot out of the devil's tail, it's important to understand that God has always been about giving us a choice. You know, we've talked in our Wednesday night class some about what is the antithesis of not having a choice. We'd be like robots, wouldn't we? Could God have created robots to follow Him regardless? We'd be mindless creatures designed for only one purpose, to follow and do His will and not have a choice. Could He have created those type of creatures? He could have done that if He had so desired. But what would be the purpose of creating a creature designed for only one purpose and following His every wish and command? He wanted us to have a choice. When God created Adam and Eve and put them in the garden, they were free, moral creatures. They were there and they could make a choice. And that's the same situation we're in today. We are free, moral creatures. We make choices each and every day. of whether or not we will choose to do God's will or Satan's will. The second nod is just a few verses later, Genesis chapter 3 and verse 4. It says, "Then the serpent said to the woman, 'You will not surely die.'" God had told them, "If you eat of this fruit, you will die." What did Satan say? "You will not die." That's all he did. He changed that one little word, that "not." He tells Eve, "You will not die." Verse 5, Satan is appealing to Eve, and he says, "For God knows that when you eat, you will be like Him." He's trying to get her to think she would be like God. And God was holding back some secret power from them. Isn't it just like mankind to think, you know, there's something that we would gain by doing this or by doing that? Satan told her, he says, "For God knows when you eat of it, your eyes will be open and you'll be like God." Genesis 3:6 says, When the woman saw that the tree was good for food, that it was pleasant to the eyes, and a tree desirable to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate. She also gave to her husband and with her, and he ate. Notice those three things: good for food, pleasant to the eyes, and desirable to make one wise. Those three things appeal to the carnal nature of mankind. And I find it interesting that Eve was the one that tempted Adam into sin. Satan may have known that Adam may have been able to resist him, but because of his love for his wife, he would have been able to resist his temptations, but he would not have been able to resist the temptation of his wife. And Eve was the one that tempted him into sin itself. Then, true to his word, God followed through with his promise. In the day that they sinned, they died spiritually, and then physically they began to die by degrees. Then the words of Romans 5:19 were true: "For as by one man's disobedience many were made sinners, so by the obedience of one shall many be made righteous." And of course, the one man making many righteous was that what we lost in Adam, we regain in Christ. So taking this knot out of the devil's tail is that one little word again, the knot: "You will not surely die." And again, recognizing the fact that these are the tools that Satan uses in order to get us to sin. The third one, to get the next knot, we have to use the King James Version in Job chapter 1 and verse 9. It says, "Satan answered the Lord and said, 'Doth Job fear God for naught?'" N-O-U-G-H-T, the Old English spelling. And let's look at this from the Message. I'm going to read Job chapter 1, verse 9 through 11 from the Message. Satan states, "So do you think Job does all that out of the sheer goodness of his heart? Why, no one ever had it so good. You pamper him like a pet. Make sure nothing bad ever happens to him or his family or his possessions. You bless everything he does. He can't lose. But what do you think would happen if you reached down and took away everything that is his? He'd curse you right to your face. That's what." That's from the Message in reading Job chapter 1, verse 9 through 11. He's basically stating, does Job fear God for naught, for nothing? In this account, I don't believe it mattered if Job had a lot of material possessions or just a few material possessions. The bottom line is what galls Satan is that he had unwavering trust in the Lord. And we see that when family members were killed and he lost his material possessions, even his own health, and his body was eaten up with sores, he was left with two things. Remember what two things Job had left when all this happened to him? He had friends that were not true friends. He had a wife that said, what was the advice that she gave to him? Curse God and die. What great advice. What great advice. His friends said, gave him bad advice, and his wife said, curse God and die. Can you ever imagine being in a situation where you've lost everything and the one person that you rely on says, that's their advice to you? Just curse God and die. That's pretty low. This is a guy that had a lot of riches. He had family. And he got to a point where he didn't even have his health. And the only advice he got from the person that he trusted was, curse God and die. Job was in a situation where 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 13 had not yet been written. But when I read about Job and the situations he came through, to me he's the epitome of what that verse says. If you read it in the Message, 1 Corinthians 10, 13, it says, no test or temptation that comes your way is beyond the course of what others have had to face. All you need to remember is that God will never let you down. He'll never let you be pushed past your limit. He'll always be there to help you come through it. Does Job fear God for nothing? For naught? And I love the way that taking that knot out of the devil's tail in that particular situation. The fourth knot in the devil's tail is from Matthew chapter 12 and verse 24. And it comes from the mouth of the Pharisees. It's not always Satan himself. It's others acting in regard to Satan and acting in behalf of Satan. It comes from the mouth of the Pharisees acting as an agent of Satan or the devil. The people had been watching Jesus and they had been seeing Jesus perform these miracles or signs that showed that he was the son of David. And the people were convinced that he was the true Messiah. And as the Pharisees saw him performing these things, firsthand witness of these signs, they were seeing these signs and they saw that he was performing. The people were convinced. Even the Pharisees were convinced of the signs, but they were denying him. They were denying verbally what they knew in their hearts. And Jesus knew they were. He knew they were denying what they knew to be true. That he was not the son. And it says that they were saying that he was not the son of David. And they attribute his signs and miracles to Beelzebub, the ruler of the demons. There's that not, that he was not the son of David. He knew their wicked thoughts. He knew that as they witnessed these miracles and signs, that they denied him in their hearts. They were seeing firsthand these things taking place. And they were blaspheming the Holy Spirit as they witnessed those things. And Jesus was saying that this blasphemy could not be forgiven. We don't have the opportunity today to firsthand witness the miracles and signs that Jesus was performing. But how many times do people deny the call of Jesus? How many times do they drive past church buildings and they have that inclination? They know what they need to be doing. Not just drive past a church building, but they have the feeling that, you know, I know what I need to do. I know that I need to respond to this. Or they know this or that in regard to the spiritual side of their nature. But they deny that. They suppress it. Happens a lot. They have a conscience, but they suppress it. That's exactly what these people were doing. They were suppressing what they knew to be true. And I'm sure there's a lot of people in the world that we live in taking the knot out of the devil's tail. The fifth knot in the devil's tail comes from Matthew 16. And it's again Satan. And he's using somebody else. And it's not always enemies of Jesus that he's using. And in this particular occasion, it's Peter himself. Matthew 16, verse 21. It says, from that time, Jesus began to show to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and be raised the third day. Then Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, far be it from you, Lord, this shall not, there's that word, this shall not happen to you. Now, Peter meant well. I'm sure he did. Peter, I just see myself so often in Peter. His mouth and his brain gets in a race, and you know what wins? His mouth wins. Do we ever do that? Mouth and brain get in a race, and guess what wins? Our mouth wins. Happens a lot, but it happened with Peter. And I think a lot of us identify with Peter. You know, he meant that from a good heart. Jesus said, we're going to go to Jerusalem, and they're going to try to kill me. And what does Peter do? Stands up like a man. He says, it ain't going to happen. He's saying, you know what? They're going to have to come through me first. And he's thinking, I'll stop them. You'll have to come through me before they get to you. He said it out of a good heart, but Jesus said to him, he says, get behind me, Satan. And I can only imagine what Peter's thinking. Lord, you called me Satan. I'm trying to help you. Don't you understand? I'm trying to save your life. And you called me Satan. You don't seem to understand. First off, do I look like Satan to you? Jesus called him Satan. It says, Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, far be it from you, Lord, this shall not, there's that word, happen to you. But he turned and said to Peter, get behind me, Satan. You are an offense to me, for you're not mindful of the things of God, but the things of men. Peter spoke this out of a good heart. And we've studied in our Wednesday night class how that even before Adam and Eve sinned in the garden, this was part of God's plan. He had a plan to fix what they had messed up before they ever messed it up. He knew what they were going to do. He didn't want them to do it. But in the chess match of life, he had already checkmated his opponent, Satan, before the game ever began. He knew this was going to happen. He had already had a way to fix it. He already knew the moves that were going to be made. He knew every move his opponent was going to make. And he already saw the chess match unfolding. He already knew how he could win the game. And this was part of the plan from the very beginning. Peter was trying to keep this from happening. But he was trying to explain to him, this is part of the plan before the foundation of the world. God had a plan. And he was trying to explain to Peter that you can't thwart the plan. Peter's thinking, I'm going to help you, God. And you know, as we look at the Bible and read about the different accounts, I think about the many times people think about they're going to help God. God said one thing. He said, this is the way it's going to be. And what do we want to do? We want to help God. God has spoken and he's told us his will time and time again. And in spite of God telling us his will, what do we want to do? I know what you said. I know what your will is, but I got a plan. Trust me here. Trust me. I got a better plan. We don't say we've got a better plan, but we got a plan. As I used to teach air traffic controllers, that's one of the things you had to teach trainees, that you got to have a plan to make the sequence work. And you got to make it work. And as you would see, young controllers have a plan. And sometimes it would be a horrible plan. And their instructors would have to step in and fix it. But what you wanted to see is the young controller say, I got a plan. The worst thing that you could see is for them to have no plan, because that was the worst thing possible. But you wanted to at least see them have a plan. But others have tried to have a plan, and they wanted to help God with their plan. Abraham was told by God he was going to make a great nation of him. Abraham had a wife. No doubt they had tried to have children before with Sarah, only to have failed. And God told him he was going to have a great nation. So what did Abraham do? Well, he probably thought, you know, we've tried this before. It didn't work. I'm going to have to help God. Well, that wasn't God's intention for Abraham to help God. Moses was told to speak to the rock. Well, he probably, maybe it was mindless. Who knows? Maybe he thought God needed some help. Maybe it seemed silly for him to speak to the rock. Thought it made more sense for him to strike the rock. So he thought he'd help God. And he struck the rock instead of speaking to the rock. And so many times, and we read about those accounts and we think, well, we can understand how they needed to do what God told them to do. But we wouldn't have done that, would we? Would we? Oh, don't you know we would have done it? I would have been the first one to do it. We do it today. The Bible tells us in Hebrews 1 that God has spoken in His Word, His will. We read about His will and we think, okay, we know that's His will, but I got a plan. I got a plan. I got a better plan. God made me this way, so it's okay for me to be this way, even though that's His plan. We do the same thing that those guys did then. That's the way for us to take the knot out of the devil's tail, is to follow God's plan. If sin can creep into these guys' lives, how much more important is it for us to be on guard against Satan's devices? The sixth knot in the devil's tail is, guess who's helping him again? It's Peter. We're picking on Peter, but he certainly gives us some vivid examples. Luke 22:54. Having arrested Jesus, they led him and brought him into the high priest's house. This is personal. They brought him to his house. But Peter followed at a distance. What you doing, Peter? Where are you going? But Peter followed at a distance. Now when they had kindled a fire in the midst of the courtyard and sat down together, Peter sat among them. That's a lesson in itself right there. I've heard it preached, warming by the devil's fire. Now when they had kindled a fire in the midst of the courtyard and sat down together, Peter sat among them. And a certain servant girl, seeing him as he sat by the fire, looked intently at him and said, "This man was also with him." But he denied him, saying, "Woman, I do not know him." There's that knot. Taking the knot out of the devil's tail. Peter's acting in regard to Satan, taking the knot out of the devil's tail. "Woman, I do not know him." And after a little while, another saw him and said, "You also are of them." But Peter said, "Man, I am not." There's that not again. Then after about an hour had passed, another confidently affirmed, and this is where it gets me. After about an hour, Peter had time to reflect on things. An hour had passed. Another confidently affirmed, saying, "Surely this fellow was with him, for he is a Galilean." But Peter saying, "Man, I do not know what you are saying." Immediately, while he was still speaking, the rooster crowed, and the Lord turned and looked at Peter. Then Peter remembered the word of the Lord, how he had said to him, "Before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times." So Peter went out and wept bitterly. Peter just witnessed getting your clothes dirty Christianity. This wasn't Sunday morning, put your tie on, put your suit on, get all purtied up, go to church. This was out there where the rubber meets the road. Who knows how we would have reacted? I'm not condemning Peter, but this is where things are serious. Peter knew that they possibly would kill him. They would crucify him at the same time. Taking the knot out of the devil's tail. The final knot is found in John 8:13. It says, "The Pharisees therefore said to Jesus, 'You bear witness of yourself. Your witness is not true.'" Your witness is not true. And you know, we live in a world where they talk about Jesus' witness being not true. We live in a world where people look at the fact that we as Christians say Jesus is the Son of God, and they say He is not the Son of God. We say that there is life after death. They say there is not life after death. We say there is a judgment day. They say there is not a judgment day. We say that there is a day in Hebrews 9:27 after that we die that God will judge us. They say there is not a judgment day. We say there is life after death. They say there is not life after death. That when you're dead, you're just like Rover. You're dead all over. That's taking the knot out of the devil's tail. That's what we're talking about when we say taking the knots out of the devil's tail. We live in a world that denies these things. What do we say? Peter, as he went through his life, later in his life, changed some of the things that he said. And I'm sure he remembered back to those course of events during the times that he walked with Jesus. And I know you know the passage I'm thinking of. 1 Peter 5:8-9. Later in his life, these words were written by Peter. He says, "Be sober. Be vigilant. Because your adversary..." And he knows he's dealing with the devil. He knows that Satan had his way with him when he was younger. He says, your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion. I don't know if Peter ever knew what a lion looked like, but he made this comparison. Have y'all ever been to the zoo to see the lions as they pace up and down the cages? Those things are massive. And they look like they just want to eat you up, don't they? And they do. And I watch some of those nature programs on some of the National Geographic shows and everything. Have you ever seen one of those lions just chomp into something? Those things are just full of power. And you know, it just looks like if they ever got loose that they could just chew you up, because they really can. And that's the example that Peter's using right here, because that's probably what he felt like. Satan was just looking for somebody to chew up, and he felt like he was the guy they chewed up on that particular time. The devil walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. And he probably felt like on that particular occasion that he was devoured. He says, resist him, steadfast in the faith, knowing that the same sufferings are experienced by your brotherhood in the world. When Jesus was in the wilderness, tempted by Satan, he quoted scripture to him. That's how he took the knots out of the devil's tail. Brother Al Edwards, I don't know if he knows the lesson that we're sharing this morning, but if he's in heaven and can hear us, I hope he feels proud of this lesson this morning. And I hope you'll remember, this is how we take the knots out of the devil's tail. We give an invitation at the end of our lessons, and we're going to do so this morning as we stand and sing. Thank you.